You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. I don't know about you, but in the 2.5-ish decades that I've been on this planet, I've become very good at talking about nothing. The weather, last night's episode of The Bachelor, whether or not a hot dog is a sandwich, which, to be clear, it is. I could talk about any one of these things for hours. What I have no idea how to talk about is anything consequential. This always becomes alarmingly clear when I begin to feel depressed. I'll feel signs start to come on, like I don't really want to go out for a run, my friend texts me and I'd just rather not text them back, or I'm trying to record an episode intro for All the Best and I just can't figure out what to say. I don't feel like myself. And then I just sit in that, not sure where to go or what to do with it. I could be pushing it down for weeks or months, and in that time I don't talk to my friends and I don't get to experience life in the joyful way that I'd like to. But I don't want to tell anyone because it's awkward. I'm scared to sound like I'm attention-seeking or to take up someone's valuable time or to sound like a failure. But sometimes I'll pluck up the courage and I'll reach out. And time again, that makes a world of difference. My psychologist will remind me that I've experienced times like this before and I've always made it through. My friends will tell me that they're always there for me. And maybe someone will even tell me that they've been there too, or they're feeling the same way. That's how I remember it's not just about me. Depression is not just my problem. It's a thing that a lot of people go through, and it's a thing that we should all be tackling together. In this week's episode, we've got stories of people figuring out how to talk about uncomfortable things. And more than that, it's about the value they've found in not carrying the weight of those uncomfortable topics all on their own. In our first story, Bridget finds herself surrounded by a community afraid to talk about her father's death. A content warning, this story contains descriptions of suicide. If you need mental health support, you can reach out to Lifeline on 13 11 14 or online at lifeline.org.au.
The 28th of May is still a bit of a blur, but I remember standing in the kitchen stark naked. I was about to jump in the shower when the phone rang. And usually I'd ignore it, but there was just something about this night that made me go downstairs and answer the call. It was my mum ringing from our childhood home in the Gold Coast, and as soon as she said my name, I just knew that whatever she was about to say next, it wasn't going to be good. She kept saying that she couldn't break the car window, that no matter how hard she tried or how many times she beat against the glass, she just could not break the car window to get to my dad. I remember falling to the floor when she told me that the police had arrived. And I remember begging her to stay on the phone. I didn't know what to say. I just wanted to know that she was there at the other end. I called my partner and told her she'd have to leave work. And then I texted my boss. I'd quit smoking, but suddenly I set myself this personal challenge of going out and finding the cheapest, nastiest pack of durries that money could buy. And I washed him down with a couple of sleeping pills on the way to the airport. I was out cold by the time the plane left Darwin, and I didn't wake up until we landed in Brisbane. My mum and brother picked me up from the airport in a hire car. And it wasn't until we pulled into Watford Crescent that I saw that car with the broken window for the first time, just parked in the driveway like Dad had knocked off work. When I walked through the doors of my childhood home, I was immediately greeted to the smell of grief. And by that, I mean lasagna. It hadn't even been 24 hours, but already people were making the rounds with the home-cooked meals. I'm sorry about your dad. Here's a lasagna. After a while, you start ranking your friends and family based on the quality of their food. It becomes this morbid game of MasterChef where you weigh up the cheese-to-sympathy ratio of each meal. Someone brought around a packet of Tim Tams and I thought, my dad's dead, Karen. You can do better. for most of that morning, people filtered in and out of the house, and I just sat on the couch underneath the pergola, completely paralysed. I decided I had to get out of there, and so I was going to go for a run. I went to the wardrobe looking for something to wear, but the only thing that I could find was this horrific, dirty, oversized tracksuit. I paired it with a pair of my mum's jazziest sneakers, and I set off down the hill from my house looking like a speed dealer trying to outrun the dog squad. And that's one of the funniest things to reflect on when I look back at that first week. I was so worried about keeping up appearances, and I'm not sure who I was trying to keep them up for. But I remember in that moment when I was running, thinking to myself, you know, I really could try to find a nicer outfit. But I was determined, you know, in that moment I was Forrest Gump. I started running and I did not stop. I had a playlist of all my dad's music. I listened to Brown Eyed Girl by Van Morrison on repeat because he used to sing it to me when I was a kid. I was his brown eyed girl. I ran through parks and abandoned lots like Kathy Freeman's much fatter, much whiter cousin. I ran down highways and side streets and I didn't know where I was going. I just knew that wherever that was, I was going to get there quickly. And I'm not sure if I was running from the crying rallies back home or the sympathy lasagnas or just the realisation that my dad, my funny, quirky, soft-spoken father, had really killed himself in the driveway of our family home. My dad's solution to life's problems was a milkshake. Whenever I'd have a problem, he'd say, "Well, Poppet, can't change the world, but I can make you a milkshake." My dad was calm and collected. He was the same man who stopped my mum from going postal when I came home with a tattoo on my thigh that may or may not have been a bit bigger than what I'd promised. Family was everything to him. He was the same man who checked my ABC profile on the morning that he took his own life, just to see if I'd written any new stories. Because right until the very end, all he ever wanted to be was a good dad. A couple of days after he passed, I went and saw a psychologist, and I remember walking into his office and saying, "What's wrong with me, Graham? Am I some kind of sociopath? Why can't I grieve properly?" And he said, "You're not a sociopath, you're a gardener." He said, "There's two types of people who grieve and both think the other is grieving incorrectly. The first group of people, they'll wear nothing but black and they'll cry for 2 years straight. And that's their process. That's their way of saying to this person who's passed, we will never forget you. And then there's this second group of people. They don't wear black, they don't cry, and their lives continue on pretty much the same. But every morning they'll get up and they'll water a tree that they planted in their loved one's honour." So he said, "You just need to find your tree." And I thought, well, that's all well and good, Graham, but I don't own a tree. I live in an apartment. I don't have a backyard. How do you propose I get a tree? And he said, "It's a metaphor, mate. Try not to overthink it." And that stuck with me. So about a week or two after Dad passed, I decided I was going to compete in a race. Running was the only thing that made sense to me. So I decided I was going to do the 10-kilometre bridge to Brisbane. I was going to raise money for Beyond Blue. And I was going to tell people what happened. I was going to come clean about my dad, and that was going to be my first tree. And I'd love to sit here and say I decided to do that because I'm a very selfless person. But the reality is it was completely self-serving. Running for a cause was a way of legitimising my tree. It was the only way that I could think of where I could legitimise my pain and my grief so that I could even give myself permission to talk about it. Because you can't just tell people that your dad killed himself. You know, how do I tell you that it took my dad 56 years to make a life and only 15 minutes to decide that he was going to end it? How do I tell you that I cry for him every day? And I wonder if there will come a time where I forget the sound of his voice. How do I tell you that I had to stand by that car with the broken window and look in the back seat where he put on a David Bowie CD and he curled up in a blanket and he ended his life to realise that that was my dad? that was the same man that I knew, but he was just a man. He wasn't the dork with a cheeky grin and a cup of tea for mum anymore. He was just a man with a David Bowie CD and a lifetime of sadness that he thought he couldn't tell us about. You can't tell people that shit. It's uncomfortable. You know, it puts a lot of pressure on people to try and find an appropriate way to respond. But running, you know, I thought that's a narrative that people can get behind. Because then you're not just the sad girl talking about her dead dad. Then you're a bloody inspiration, you know. You're running for a cause. You're not going to let your sadness get the best of you. You're doing something about it. My whole job as a journalist is to try and give the world shape through words, but for the first time in my life, I didn't have any. And so I approached my dad's death like I would a story at work. I shaped a narrative that I thought would be easy to digest. And I went through and I edited and I sub-edited my grief so that I didn't make people too uncomfortable. I didn't want to come across as too sad. And even when my world was falling apart around me, I was more concerned with making my grief stomachable for other people than being able to say, I'm struggling and I don't know that I'm going to be okay. But then something changed, because as soon as I started talking, people started talking back. The language of loss was universal, but I had to give myself permission to speak about it before I could give other people the permission to respond. And they did. You know, people reached out to me to tell me about their own struggles with depression and anxiety. People contacted me to say, you know what, I'm fine, but I don't know that my brother is, so I'm going to give him a call tonight, and I'm going to do that in your dad's honour. And now I find myself having these conversations with people that I wish I could have had with my dad. Because I would do anything to have one last conversation with him. I would give the world to tell him how much I loved him, how much he had to live for. How every time I see a father with his daughter, I feel like I've been hit by a freight train. I'd do anything to drink one last dodgy milkshake with the egg that was never mixed properly, or to have him measure my ear-to-eye ratio because he thought it was a measure of low IQ. But I can't. All I can do now is water my tree. So on August 26, just short of 3 months since my dad passed, I'm going to run my 10-kilometre race. And I know that my dad will be there with me every step of the way, singing along to Van Morrison off-key. And I know that with every step that I run, I can only become more powerful, because through struggle comes strength. And I feel like the biggest wanker saying that out loud, but it's true. Through struggle comes strength. With every step that I run, my muscles break down, but they come back bigger and better and stronger than before. And I think if my body can do that, then why can't my mind? I didn't choose this situation, but I can choose how I respond. So I'm going to run my stupid, stupid race. And I'm probably going to cross the finish line and come to the realisation that I still feel just as shitty as I do now. But that's okay, because then I'll plant my next tree. And I don't know what that's going to be yet, but I know I'm going to end up with a backyard full of them. And they are going to be so big and so strong that the neighbours are going to have to go and get the council involved. And I know that over time, as the months and the years pass, there will come a point where I don't have to plant any more trees. And when that time comes, I'll just sit in my backyard and I'll look out at them all and I'll marvel at what I've created. And I'll think to myself, fuck, what a weird and wonderful life it has been. And I'm going to do that for my dad.
If this story brought up anything for you, you can reach out for confidential support from Lifeline on 13 11 14 or online at lifeline.org.au. That story was told by Bridget Judd. It was produced by Sam Carmody. Bridget told this story at Spun, a live storytelling night presented by Story Projects in the Northern Territory. You can subscribe to the Spun Stories podcast and find out more about the Spun Storytelling Project by visiting spunstories.net. You can also look for Spun Stories on Facebook and Twitter. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Maddie McQueen. All the Best is about training emerging Australian storytellers in the art of audio. If you'd like to be a part of the show, you can start by pitching to us at allthebestradio.com. We'll pair you with one of our supervising producers to help make your story. Prue Dawson has been a feminist for over 40 years. In our next story, she reflects on what she calls vulval angst.
This story is about my lips. No, not these lips. I mean our labia, vulva, vagina, or pussy, yoni, buju, fanny, the C word, which we're usually not allowed to say on air. We have so many words for this part of us, but they're words that many of us avoid even saying out loud. It all started last year. It was Sunday morning and I was sitting on my bed with my iPad, Guardian Online, a coffee, the sun flooding in. Perfect start to the day, and I found this article about a book called Womanhood, The Bare Reality by Laura Dodsworth. I was shocked. There was a square, 10 by 10, of 100 pictures of women's vulvae, all the same size, different colours, shapes, just there, exposed. They looked so vulnerable and fleshy, sitting on a page, not glossy, just there, these hidden parts we seldom look at. It's not porn, not medical, it's not arty, just there, private and quiet, tender, not altered in any way. Before I knew it, I was sobbing. I look, and I hate to admit it, I was slightly revolted, but also a bit excited. I knew I'd come up against the taboo. I thought I liked my body, enjoyed sex, but there was something deeply unsettling about looking at these images. What was it? What was about looking at 100 vulvae that left me so speechless? Once you start looking, vulvae are everywhere. In fact, over the last 10 years or so, there's been quite a campaign of artists, journalists and health educators publishing and displaying images of this body part that's always been so taboo. There's the Vagina Museum in London, which launched last year with their exhibition Muffbusters, Vagina Myths and How to Fight Them. There's the pioneering play by Eve Ensler, The Vagina Monologues, which is still being performed and celebrated its 25th anniversary. And then there's Gwyneth Paltrow's candle, you know, the one which bears the label, "This candle smells like my vagina." In 2016, The Guardian newspaper invited women to send in drawings of their vulva, which they published online. They were astonished to receive over 21,000 entries, which they called the Great Wall of Vulvas. They also got over 100 drawings of Volvo cars. One of the most popular vulva exhibits that I've seen is at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart. It consists of 151 life-size, three-dimensional white porcelain portraits of women's vulvae displayed upon a wall. Originally there were 150, but the gallery's owner's wife requested one more. It was created by artist Greg Taylor in 2008. And for those who want a different sensory experience, vulvae soaps are popular items for sale in the gift shop. When you see these images, the first thing that strikes many people is just how different each one is. And that's because the motivation for all of this art was largely what I like to call vulval angst, the deep worry that many women and girls feel about the shape and size of their vulva, the sense that their labia are ugly, disgusting, weird. In 2020, women still seem to be deeply embarrassed about our labia. We know this is still true by the shocking numbers of women and girls who want to undergo labiaplasty. This is surgery, typically to reduce the size of women's labia, sometimes due to physical discomfort like mine, but most frequently is to make them look neater or prettier. In fact, labiaplasty numbers have grown substantially in many countries, and in 2018, almost 1,200 procedures were carried out in Australia alone. British influencer Tracy Kiss famously broadcast her labiaplasty surgery as a video log, and now wears the excised parts of her labia encased in plastic as jewellery around her neck. She has 2.9 million followers. I have to applaud her blatant confidence, but I do find this all quite disturbing. When I was 10 years old, I remember feeling embarrassed about my labia too. I had an outy lip, and I remember it chafing against my jeans as I was running through the park. I knew other girls didn't seem to have this trouble when I took a quick peek when we got changed for swimming. I wanted to ask someone about it, to check that I was normal, but somehow I knew that I couldn't talk to anyone about this, not my mum, my sister, my friends, or anyone else, that this was down there and unmentionable. By the time I was in my 20s, it was the 1970s, and I was part of the women's liberation movement. I remember consciousness-raising self-examination groups where we sat on the floor in a circle and each took a speculum which we would gently insert into our vaginas, and we would look at our cervix with mirrors and torches. We believed that knowing our vaginas was a starting point for knowing ourselves and becoming strong. We wanted to own our bodies, to overcome the shame we'd been taught to feel about anything to do with down there, as our mothers would call it. But it wasn't that easy. It seems to me that in many ways, young women now are more repressed than I was growing up in the 60s and 70s. All women have a story about their bodies that they've never told. For us, our vulva are our most private and powerful body part. When I think about my own body, it's extraordinary, really, to remember that two babies' heads have come from inside those lips, and I've accommodated many lovers, including myself. And of course, we were all born between women's lips. As Laura Dodsworth says in her book, Bare Reality, they are the site of our deepest shame, our fiercest pleasure, the most intimate moments, and the most terrible traumas. That morning in bed, I'm still not sure why I was moved by seeing these images of vulvae, but I do know that some residual shame and disappointment still exists for me about my labia. I think I cried from relief that I'm normal, that there is no normal. And what I'd hidden away and felt ashamed about was just so unimportant. And these 100 brave women had bared their most intimate and powerful body part to show me that. These pictures, together with the stories they told, revealed something. By showing what must not be seen, a silence is broken. And I'm left with a sadness for what I've lost, living my life with this unease about my lips, lost pleasure, lost opportunities. I wonder how things might have been if I could have fearlessly enjoyed my body, what the world might be like if all women could strut around with pride.
That story was produced by Prue Dawson. The supervising producer was Eugenia Zubchenko. There's a scene in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where Zaphod Beeblebrox, Ford Prefect, and Trillian find a point of view gun.
The point of view gun, conveniently, does precisely what its name suggests. That is, if you point it at someone and pull the trigger, they instantly see things from your point of view.
Give me that thing.
Sophie Hope wishes this was a real thing. She has OCD and she's frustrated by the way it's misunderstood, mischaracterized, and trivialized in pop culture. A content warning, this story contains detailed descriptions of Sophie's obsessions and compulsions.
I might be going to a class and, you know, someone will give me a hug and I feel like the person is on me still. So they've let go and I feel like the person is on me still and their sort of presence in a strange way, their presence is like still there. I really want to get rid of that presence because if I don't, I'm going to be stuck becoming more them and less me. And I sort of can visually see slash feel like they're on me. So wherever has been touched, I need to somehow get rid of. And so I might need to take off whatever clothes I'm wearing and get changed. I might need to have a shower. But the most common one I can do in public, you know, is use antibacterial hand sanitizer. That's probably the only difficulty I've really had with COVID at the minute is that went out of stock for a while and luckily I had some supply. I have heaps of obsessions and compulsions and some of them are related to each other and some aren't. And that's usually the case with people with OCD. Usually people don't just have one. So one of the ones I experience, my obsession is I'm going to cause a fire and my compulsions are varied. One compulsion I have is to make sure that the light switches don't spark when I turn them off and the PowerPoints don't spark when I turn them off. So I might turn them on and off several times. I might check, I might stand there and wait, or I might go away for 5 minutes and come back and make sure they haven't sparked or caused a fire. Another compulsion I have to help ease that is to make sure I don't scuff my feet along a carpet because my head's like, I'm going to cause a spark if my shoes sort of scuff along a carpet. So if I feel like I've done that, I like go back to the spot and like tap it down to try and like put out the fire that doesn't yet exist. Sometimes it will take me 4 hours between getting up and leaving for work, and that's just literally like doing compulsions the majority of that time. Checking is really big for me in the morning, so checking I have everything, checking the house, checking it's not going to burn, checking and checking and checking, checking I have everything, and like going over and over and over everything. I have an obsession that I'm going to forget something, I'm going to lose something, or I'm going to leave something somewhere. So I have like a list that I go over in my head, and I can go over that multiple times. Like one that I say a lot is phone, wallet, keys. And I say phone, wallet, keys, like I don't even know how many times in a day, and it will just go in my head, phone, wallet, keys, phone, wallet, keys, phone, wallet, keys, phone, wallet, keys. And sometimes I'll have to say phone, wallet, keys so many times that it'll be exhausting. Or I'll have to say it before I move on, so I'm not usually able to like do something at the same time. And then it just needs to reach a point where it feels right within me to stop and be able to move on. And that can just take like literally hours, use my entire energy for the day. It is difficult to see anything that isn't just a waste of time. Like I often have a mantra, especially if I'm not in a good headspace, that goes through my head like, waste of time, this is a waste of time, I've wasted my time, spent so much time on this, it hurts all the people around me, like it hurts me, it wastes my time, wastes everyone else's time. Yeah, it's just something you just want to like get out of. I specifically have been trying not to mention hand washing because that's the one thing that people think of. It's the one thing I just absolutely can't relate to. And it's the one thing that a lot of people I know with OCD can't relate to either. Unfortunately, I think humans are sort of wired that we have a really hard time of being able to empathize or, you know, have our theory of mind with people unless we've experienced something ourselves or unless we've really heard a detailed story of someone else who's experienced something. We can't make everyone experience OCD and I would never wish that on anyone. But if people could hear more detailed stories, like real life stories of what people experience and what it might look like inside their brain, would be helpful.
That story was produced by Danny Stewart, Dan Simo, and Ryan Pemberton for the 24-hour radio race from KCRW's Independent Producer Project. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. This episode was mixed and compiled by Alina Godwin. Our executive producer is Ryan Pemberton. Jordan Fennell is our Victorian State Coordinator. The All the Best community coordinators are Chloe Gillespie and Danny Stewart. Our SYN community coordinator is Lee Robinson. Matilda Fay and Angela Moran are our social media producers, and I'm your host, Maddie McQueen. Shining Bird composed our theme music, and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. We're heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and we're made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. You can find more episodes by searching for All the Best wherever you get your podcasts.